History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, even if they've been held back for decades, because sometimes all it takes is somebody who is interested enough to ask a few questions and who cares enough to patiently listen as those memories rise to the surface. Maybe you'll have the chance to do that with a veteran in your life, but that's what we try to do here as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week has been an important week for a really special group of veterans. When I've had the chance to listen to their memories over the years, I know it has really impacted my perspective, because who could possibly understand the value of freedom more than those who have experienced what life is like without it? I'm talking, of course, about those who have spent time as prisoners of war, and we've heard dozens of them on this program. National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Recognition Day is observed each year on the third Friday in September. Maybe you want to think ahead and find it on your calendar for next year right now, but this year it was Friday, September 17th, and at hometownheroesradio.com I have a link to this year's proclamation from the White House. Here's a quick excerpt for you. On National POW MIA Recognition Day, we remember the debt we owe to them and to their families. We pay tribute to our former prisoners of war and recommit to the difficult but essential task of seeking out answers for the families of those still missing. We will always remember and honor our nation's prisoners of war and those still missing in action, and keep faith with our promise as a nation to bring all of our heroes home. Again, that's the proclamation signed by President Joe Biden. And yes, there are still so many heroes missing in action. The latest numbers from the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency list more than 81,600 Americans from World War II through today who are still missing in action. About half of those are presumed to be lost at sea. National POW MIA Recognition Day is a chance for the rest of us to remember them, to pray for their families, and ultimately to understand once again that our freedom is not free, and try to grasp just how much our fellow Americans have endured to secure our freedom. We certainly get a taste of that when we listen to our ex-prisoners of war, and we're going to hear a couple of those stories on today's episode. Two men who never knew each other but had very similar experiences in some of the same POW camps and even the same forced march in Europe. Al Finley grew up in Oklahoma. He would end up seeing most of the world throughout a 29-year Air Force career, with many of his crewmates never knowing he had been a prisoner of war. That POW experience began for him on his 26th mission as a B-24 radio man with the 466th Bomb Group.
We'd been to the target and bombed Magdeburg, and we were on a return trip. We were flying over the Ruhr Valley. We flew through a flak shield. I don't think it was there all the time. I think it must have just started about the time we got there. Oof. Anyway, we got hit at number one engine and set it on fire. We were hit in the rear part of the aircraft. So I got out of my position. It wasn't far to between the pilot and co-pilot. I think our interphone was out the same way, the reason I did that. The engineer got out of it. He flew the Upper Martin turret, and he got out of the turret, and we were both standing by the pilot and the co-pilot, and the pilot said, "Bill, the engineer, go back to the rear and check the controls back there." He said, I can't control the airplane."
So maybe the cables to the rudder had been severed or damaged?
Yes. Okay. So Bill went back to the bomb bay and went back to the rear and gone a very short time, and he came back and said that the controls were cut. And also all three gunners had been wounded and they're in bad condition. And then he said, "I'm going to go back and take them." And I said, "Work over them, you know." And I said, "I'll go back with you too." And as I turned to go, the pilot grabbed my arm and said, "Al, start throwing everything over out of the bomb bay that you can. The flak suits, the flak helmets, even if you get your radios loose, but I can't hold the altitude. So I started doing that. And first thing I know, I look back up and the co-pilot was standing up, getting his parachute, and he said, "Bail out, bail out." So I grabbed my chute, and it was a chest chute, and hooked it on my chute. I took my GI boots that was beside me, and as I went out, I put them on the catwalk. Then I bailed out, and I left my shoes on the catwalk. But anyway, I was so low that we were so low that I saw two sheets come out after I went. I didn't see the airplane crash. I saw the airplane kind of climb and fall off, but I never did see it crash because when I hit the ground, I hit it so hard it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for I don't know how long laying there. And when I woke up, there were three German, I assume they were farmers, standing over me. Two of them had pitchforks, and the other one had a gun. Again, I was so kind of woozy, I didn't really know what was going on, you know. The one with the gun pointed at my head, you know, and I thought, I bought the farm, you know. And then he turned the gun away and fired it, and then started laughing. And then I must have passed out again, because the next thing I knew, I was in a farmhouse. One of them was there, and a woman was there, and somebody had taken my wristwatch and my dog tags. They'd gone through my clothes, you know. I tried to ask how I got there, and they showed me a wheelbarrow. They'd put me in a wheelbarrow and rolled me in a wheelbarrow to where it was. It was after dark when somebody came back with the police and took us to the local jail. I say us, it took me to the local jail, but the others were in the jail. There were the co-pilot and the navigator and the nose gunner. The pilot wasn't there because they didn't see his chute open, and he was loose in the country for about 2 weeks before he turned himself in. But there was the nose gunner and myself, the co-pilot and the navigator.
So that's four of you there at that jail.
There was five of them. Well, yeah, four of us. That's right. Because the pilot wasn't there. Okay, I'm trying to get five out of it.
Well, and the math, so everybody listening understands, you had nine men on the plane.
The bombardier wasn't flying then because what they had done was take the nose gunner, and as the lead aircraft would drop their bombs, he would toggle the bomb. So we lost the bombardier, really.
So you've got a nine-man crew.
Yes.
And you talked about the three gunners in the back being wounded.
Yes.
They all went down with the plane?
They all went down with the plane, plus the engineer went down with the plane, and there was nothing wrong. He had gone, he was got caught back there.
He was back trying to help them.
That's right.
And it cost him his
life. So nobody knows how bad they were injured or what was going on in the rear of the aircraft, but Bill, the engineer, and he went down.
Did you guys know that at the time? That they had not survived?
Well, we'd known that they'd gone. We didn't know that, but assumed the airplane crashed. We didn't know they'd be killed. We didn't know that till the Germans told us.
You mentioned how hard you hit the ground because you had to bail out at such low altitude.
Yes, yes.
You hit it so hard it knocked you unconscious. Did you have injuries as a result of that?
Just my back, the lower part of my back. It was hard. It was hard for me to sit down, so I hurt the lower part, tailbone or something.
But when you find yourself at this jail and you see some familiar faces, that had to mean a lot to you to see them.
That's right, yes. My navigator, Rock Kramer, could understand a little German, but he didn't let him know that he understood German, you know. But anyway, he told us, he said, "Don't say anything about Magdeburg." He said, "One of these fellows has got a mother or something that lives in where we just bombed, you know." Ooh. So he said, "Don't say anything about Magdeburg."
Yeah, and you can laugh about it now. Yeah, but at the time, I'm sure there was a real fear that these people could kill you.
Yes, there was a real fear, We spent one night in the jail, the local jail, and then the next afternoon, an officer, I think a lieutenant in the Luftwaffe, and a sergeant came to pick us up. He had a machine gun that he carried. They put us on a passenger train, and we went to Essen, which was a town in the Ruhr Valley. About the time we got there, it was, the British were starting with bombing. So they took us off the train and took us down to underground. A lot of civilians were there that time, and they didn't care much for us. And they kind of started walking towards us, you know. The officer said something to the sergeant, and he pulled up his machine gun, and they backed away. But so it was just that way until the bombing was over, and then we went up, got back on the train. And it's very kind of vague now. I don't know what it took, a day or 2 days to get to Oberursel, which is the interrogation center. I was in solitary confinement for 11 days, and the navigator was in solitary confinement for 13 days. And the other, let's see, Smitty was a nose gunner, and they let him go early. The pilot wasn't there yet. He was still running around loose in the country. But I was there for 11 days, and then they put me on a boxcar on the train.
Before we hear about that,
okay,
11 days there in solitary with not a lot to eat or drink, probably not even that much room to stretch out in, I would imagine, huh?
I had a bucket for a toilet, and I had a straw mattress. Not much more in there, no.
And what about the actual interrogation? What kinds of things did they try to get out of you?
Well, it wasn't not what I thought, though. They wanted to know about the V2 bombs, what the English were thinking of, you know, how much of a damage it's causing in England, actual damage, and then, you know, if it's the people are scared and stuff like that. Mm. But as far as military, I had very few questions about that because he knew more about my outfit than I did.
I've heard a lot of guys say that.
Yeah, he knew more my commanding officer's name, et cetera, et cetera. But they'd got it from previous people, I guess, you know. But most of my interrogation was not sensible questions, you know. They were just like they about the British, et cetera, et cetera. And do you think the war is going to be over soon, you know? My interrogator was a Captain Rubel.
And how was his English?
Good. Very excellent English, yes, yeah.
A lot of those interrogators they had spent a lot of time in the States.
Yeah, I bet. So, yeah.
Well, and you said they asked you, when do you think the war is going to be over? Again, I'm thinking about you. This is February 1945. You don't know that the war is going to be over in 3 months.
No, I don't know.
I mean, I imagine the future had to be a real uncertain thing for you at that point.
Well, it would have to be, yeah.
And how did you handle that? How did you deal with that reality that, hey, I may never get out of captivity or I may die in captivity?
I don't think that ever involved, I never thought of that, you know, because looking back, when we were hauling gasoline to Pat, they were moving so fast against the Germans. They're running, you know, in other words, their supplies couldn't keep up with them. So it wouldn't be too long, you know. We were told that not to try to escape because the war is going to be over pretty soon. So they took away our guns so we couldn't get in trouble. That just implied that, well, you know, it's not going to be long now.
That said, there was plenty of trouble for you in the months that followed and even in the days. So you mentioned 11 days there at the interrogation center, and then they put you on another one of these 40 and 8s, packed in with a bunch of other POWs.
Yes.
How tightly were you packed?
You couldn't sit down. You had to stand. You had to stand. It wasn't too far to Wetzlar. Actually, it was a transit camp because I'd been in my flying clothes for all this time, 11 or 12 days. I hadn't shaved. I hadn't showered. I was still wearing my flying boots. And so at Wetzlar, we got a shower, shave, and change of clothes. I think maybe the Red Cross had something to do with it, you know. But I got boots and et cetera, and was there about, I guess I was there about 3 days. And then they put us back on the boxcars, again, crammed in like sardines. And we hadn't gone too far that day, and we got attacked by our own fighters. And they strafed we were just crammed in there. And
So everyone understands, you're on this boxcar, and you know from a lot of your missions, a lot of the targets are railroads and marshalling logs.
Oh, yes.
And they're trying to take out the supplies before they get to the front line.
So
they don't know what's in these boxcars.
That's right.
So your own American planes are shooting the boxcar that you're in.
That's right. That's right.
And you saw people get hit.
Yes, 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 yes. I was several casualties, yeah. And the Germans finally opened the doors and let us out. And there was a forest right clumped of trees close to the track. And we were running for that. And the fighters saw that, I guess, and they stopped firing because they assumed it was either a troop train or carrying supplies or something, you know. It wasn't marked or anything. So they were probably shooting anything that moved in at that time.
Yeah. Boy, I can't imagine how scary that must be, how helpless a feeling that is.
You are helpless, yeah. You can't fight back. You can't do anything but run.
But you survived that.
Survived that. Then went to Nuremberg. And Nuremberg was just packed with prisoners. Just terrible. Had lice, bed bugs, roaches, all that stuff.
And what'd you have to eat?
Very, very, very little. Very little. I have a piece of German bread that tastes like sawdust. A soup invariably had little dead insects in it. That was about our food. Every once in a while, we would get some Red Cross parcels, but they'd puncture all the cans, so you had to eat them right away or let them spoil, you know. Mm. So they were pretty tricky on that. Nuremberg was another place that the British loved to bomb the Nuremberg, and our camp was very close to the town, and we would just bounce on them when they started bombing.
And what did your family know, if anything, about what had happened to you?
I don't think they knew anything, nothing.
Had you been reported missing? Did they get a telegram or anything?
Well, I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But later, they were told I was missing, and then when it was POW, they knew that I was a prisoner of war, yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes and how lonely and desperate and seemingly hopeless that scenario could be. I mean, you're on the other side of the world from your family. You've lost your freedom. You're not getting anything to eat. What was it that kept you going or kept your hope burning?
Well, a few prayers now and then I think didn't hurt, you know. You had somebody upstairs that was looking after you. So I felt pretty confident with that.
It's time for our first break, but we'll pick up Al Finley's POW story when we come back. Perhaps his story parallels the story of somebody in your life. And if you know an ex-prisoner of war, or maybe you know the family of one of those 81,000 still missing, how about reaching out this weekend and letting them know that you're thinking of them? That's why National POW MIA Recognition Day was instituted in the first place. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Recognition Day. When we left off, we were listening to Al Finley's POW story. If you have a chance to visit the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California, you will see Al's name on a plaque on the wall. But there's also some significance to every plaque bordering his, and it goes back to that 26th and final mission that he flew as a B-24 radio man in World War II. We're going to get to that once he takes us through the rest of his POW experience.
We started on the march on leaving Nuremberg on the 4th of April in the afternoon. We hadn't gone too long, maybe 2 hours or something, and we were under a train trestle. And we got hit with three more American fighters. The first one strafed, and the second one started strafing and then stopped. And then the third one peeled off and didn't strike. So they must have recognized that we were POWs or something. Then after that, we had toilet paper, and we made a big sign out in a field, POW, you know. So, in other words, one plane saw that, because from then on, there was one plane that flew every day would come and check on us, where we were, etc. I'm glad they knew we were there and who we were.
I guess so, because otherwise there's nothing solid to hold on to. I mean, you don't know where you're going. You don't know how long it's going to take.
That's right. That's right.
You hadn't had much to eat. I have to think this was exhausting to be marching every day.
Yeah, and the weather was bad. It was raining, and it was really a bad trip. It took us about almost 2 weeks. I think we got to Mooseburg in about somewhere around the 20th of April, I think. A week before we were liberated.
Well, I'm trying to remember when your birthday is. Isn't it in April?
Yeah, it's 14th of April. I spent it on the march.
So your 22nd birthday, you're marching from one prison camp to another.
Yes.
I imagine you don't forget that birthday.
No.
Did you even know what day it was?
Oh, I knew it was 14th. I think President Roosevelt had died on the 12th of April.
Yep.
So that was saddening news we got, you know. And I don't think we got it until on my birthday, you know. I remember there was four or five of us. We sat down in a field, you know, and I said, well, this is my birthday. So they sang happy birthday to me. But, you know, on the march, there was several times you're walking along, you know. And old German ladies would come out with a sack, and they'd have like potato, and hand us a potato, you know. And it's just heartwarming to think that they would do that, you know, after all the bombing and stuff that we had done.
Yeah, that shows some real compassion.
That's right.
And, you know, you mentioned saying a lot of prayers and feeling that somebody was looking out for you. But as the days and weeks went by, were there days where you wondered and you thought, am I going to make it to tomorrow? How's this going to end up?
I don't think so. I think, in other words, once we left Nuremberg, we know we left because Patton was so close that they had to move it.
Yeah.
And once we got to Moosburg, I don't think there was any further place to go. So, like I say, on the 29th of April, they came in. We knew something was happening that morning. I'm quite sure. I think it seemed like it was on a Sunday, but it was the 29th of April. He got up, and everything was so quiet, and the guards were gone. So we knew something had happened. And a couple of planes flew over and wiggled their, you know, and it wasn't long until the GIs came in.
Well, and it wasn't just the GIs. I mean, this is the one camp that General Patton himself showed up to liberate.
Patton came in to Moosburg about 2 days after they liberated us. Uh-huh. I know he was on a jeep or a half track or something, standing up, and his shiny helmet and his pearl-handled pistols.
You're there in this huge crowd of POWs.
Oh, yeah.
And you see this famous general who you've all known about and heard about standing up there with, as you described it. What did that feel like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It really was, yeah. If you had a little faith in our government, in our military then, you know. But, yeah, it was really a sight.
Did he say anything? Did he give a little speech or anything? Or?
No. Just came through and just waved saluting, you know.
So you said when you took off for that last mission, you probably weighed around 170.
That's right, yeah.
So what about when you got liberated?
I was about 135.
So in 3 months, you lost 20% of your body weight.
I guess so, yes.
So what about from there? When you've had to live for 3 months without freedom and you don't know when you're going to get it again, what does it feel like to realize, hey, I'm not a prisoner anymore, I'm a free man again?
It was hard to realize, really. They kept us there after we were liberated for about a week. But they brought in the food, and the white bread tastes like angel food cake, you know. And in some ways, they gave us too much food, you know. There was a lot of sickness, eating too much. But they flew a bunch of us to Camp Lucky Strike, which was on the French coast. And I was at Lucky Strike for, I would think, 2 to 3 weeks. They gave us eggnog every day and food and stuff and debriefed us and all this stuff. So.
And I've seen a photograph of your POW mugshot that the Germans took. Is that where you got that? Or where did you come across that? Did you get it when they liberated the camp, or did you get it at Lucky Strike?
You mean my POW?
The one the Germans took.
Well, I didn't have that until 2008.
Oh, really?
A gentleman was looking for his people in POW back in Maryland, and he found a whole box of about 175 pictures, and they were all prisoner of war, and mine was in one of them. So
wow.
It had my serial number on it. So through that, they traced it to where I was living in Hemet, California.
So more than 60 years later, this comes out of the blue.
2008.
Most of the guys that he found in that file were probably gone. You were probably one of the few that was still living.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible. That had to make your day.
Oh, it did. I didn't recognize the picture at first, you know. I never talked to much about I don't, my wife of 52 years, she never asked me anything about it, and I never volunteered anything. She knew I was a prisoner of war, but that was it. Mm. I never discussed it with her, et cetera, you know. It was only the private part of my life and a sad part of my life, but I had to live it anyway.
And after they nurse you back to health there in La Havre at Camp Lucky Strike, they get you back here to the States. A lot of guys have talked about sailing into New York Harbor, going past the Statue of Liberty. Did you have that experience or not?
Yes, I saw the statue. That was wonderful, yeah.
I mean, it just seems like there might be a little more significance to that statue for someone who had been through what you had been through.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. It really warms your heart to see that, you know.
What about seeing your family again?
Oh, I was glad, happy to see my family, yeah. I met my dad walking down the street.
You didn't know he was going to be there?
He didn't know I was going to be there. And I didn't know he was going to be there. So that was quite an exciting time, yeah.
Wow. A picture of that would be something. Yeah, see the look on your guys' faces.
Would have been.
You mentioned that this was a difficult part of your life. And from what I understand, maybe one of the most difficult circumstances was after you got discharged, you went to college at the University of Oklahoma for a couple semesters.
Yes.
And the reason you had to leave was you were having nightmares, flashbacks.
Yes.
How did that manifest?
It was very often. I was back in the airplane. My roommate said he couldn't sleep with all the racket that I was making, you know. So that was one reason I quit school again. I couldn't cut the mustard with a bunch of young kids anymore, you know.
Well, and I mean, this sounds like a real, I don't know if debilitating is the word, but a real difficult reality to live with, because you can't control when these things are coming on.
Well, you know, in other words, at that time they called it battle fatigue, yeah. And now they call it PTSD. That went on for a long time. I was back in that airplane for many, many, many times.
Does that ever happen anymore?
Very seldom. Maybe once in a blue moon, every 3 minutes or something, well, I will have that. I've felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but the pilot said you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right, that's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hat. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. Bill's—he's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were, you, other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he's found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went back right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child. Mm.
So when you say you felt guilty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
Yes.
And do you know, were their bodies ever found?
Yes, they were buried. I've got some German papers and stuff that they sent me when it was all declassified. The Air Force sent it to me, and it covers a lot of the period I was over there, and it did say where the men were buried. You know, when the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know, and so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know. Like I say, I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right, that's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70 some years. And that's happened, and I think a big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
That's not free. That costs some money to do that.
That's beside the point.
Well, that is my point.
Okay.
Because what you got from doing that, from honoring those guys from your crew who aren't here anymore, sounds like that satisfaction and that maybe closure that you developed from that is priceless.
I feel that way, yes.
Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I'm thankful that I'm an American. The way of life, I've been to so many foreign countries now since after the war and have seen different kind of life. Nothing comes up to our standards, so I'm proud and love to be American.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, the memories of another ex-POW who found himself in many of the same places as Al Finley did while praying he would make it home to see his wife and meet their child for the first time. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an installment marking National POW MIA Recognition Day. No one ever plans on becoming a prisoner of war, but for those who do endure that reality, their perspective is forever changed. And in listening to their stories over the years, I know I always hear something that opens my eyes, often revealing things that I take for granted that I really shouldn't. Jerry Gleasing was a young aviator from North Dakota with a pregnant wife back home. His first mission as a B-24 co-pilot included his fellow pilot getting wounded in the cockpit. His second mission became even more of a nightmare.
We were going to Vienna, Austria, to bomb a marshaling yard, and we did. We made it up to Vienna all right, and the flak didn't seem as bad as the day we went into northern Italy, and it's kind of more off in the distance. I looked across at another group of planes that were getting hit a lot harder than we were, and apparently we got hit. I don't know for sure if we got hit, but as we dropped our bombs and as we went into the rally and left, we started losing engines, and we lost an engine, and eventually the prop winds up and ran away on us and had to eventually use the feathering button to get it down. It wouldn't hold. You let go of it a little bit and it'd start winding up again. So if you let them go, they might fly off of there, but if they don't and just engine stops, they'll just sit out there and windmill, and they're a terrible drag that way. So we feathered the engine and it was dead, and the props turned into the wind. So that was the lightest load. And we looked at each other. The rest of them were gone by then. They had left us. We still had engines. We thought we were going to make it home all right. We had three engines.
But all the rest of the planes in your formation are still going full speed. So you're all alone.
You got a little bit lonesome because they were higher than you, and they took off and disappeared. Eventually, we lost three engines. And we, to this day, I, of course, don't know what really caused it all, but we did lose them all in the same manner. And got down to one, and we couldn't hold altitude, or we couldn't hold speed or anything. So the pilot gave the order to bail out, and by now we were over hungry, and that's when we all bailed out.
Did that seem to go by very quickly, or did it seem to be dragging on and kind of torturing you for a while?
Well, we were trying to get that plane going so we could get home, so I just can't tell you if it seemed like it was
it sounds pretty intense
dragging out, but we were busy. We were very busy, and time didn't seem that important. It just tried to get it going again so we could get out of here. But
so here they told you, your first mission, you'll never have one quite like that again. 24 more, that gives you 25. You get to go home and see your wife. And by then, your son, Michael, right?
Yeah, we expected a son.
But
didn't turn out that way, but that's what we expected.
So, but the Joe, your captain, your pilot, gives the order, bail out.
Bail out, yeah. And we were still there fussing with it, trying to make it go. And I assumed that all the rest of the crew was gone. And I was getting nervous about the altitude, and he was still working with that thing. And so I finally got out of the seat and hit him on the shoulder, and I said, Joe, I'm leaving, or I'm going, whatever I said. And I get back to the Bombay, which is just a short distance there, and here's the engineer squatted down, ready to go out of the hole, and the navigator right behind him. And he doesn't go, and he stands back up. So we're screaming at him to go, go, go. So the next time he gets down, the navigator didn't give him a chance to stand back up again. He just got on him and shoved him out through the Bombay. And then he went, and then I went. And the rest of the crew was on the ground by then, I'm sure.
And you didn't
you didn't know when or if Joe was going to get out of the plane.
That's another thing that bothered me, because he didn't get out of the seat right away, and as far as I knew, he was still there when I went out the door, and I worried about that for a long time. He did land in Yugoslavia, which was on the other side of the river. There's a short distance there where there's a river that's the border between Hungary and Yugoslavia, and he landed on the other side.
So you are out the bomb bay doors, your parachute's deployed, you're floating down toward a place you've never been before, you have no idea what's going to greet you. What's going through your mind as you coast down towards?
Oh, that's the first thing that hit me was the chute opened up, and I'm still there, and I had this escape bag wrapped around, the handle wrapped around my hand so that I could have something on the ground when I got there, little food in it, and that's a .45 automatic pistol in it. Mm-hmm. And but the first thing that hit me when that chute opened up and I looked down, I thought, oh, gosh, I haven't got a friend in the world down there that mm-hmm. I know about anyway. So anyway, that's the first thought I had. I've got a friend down there.
And you think about your wife?
When
the baby
I hit,
to come?
Well, at that point, I didn't. When I hit the ground and got free of my parachute, and I like to tell that I was not nervous about it at all, I got up and started running, and when I hit the end of the ropes of the parachute, why, it pulled me back on the ground again. So, but I knew what I was doing at all times. Anyway, the next, then I jerked myself out of the parachute and was up, and I hear these guys come out of the woods, you know, and they're carrying tools of their trade. So one would have a pick in his hand and another one a shovel and that kind of stuff. And
these are Hungarian civilians.
They are Hungarians. I didn't realize they were Hungarians at the time. I didn't know exactly where we were. And so, in fact, our navigator had told us how far we were from the Russian lines and that maybe we could make it, but we didn't. And anyway, these guys come running out of there, and I was scared. And so I was running the other way, and I saw the nose gunner. So I ran over to him, and I just thought I was scared. He could not talk. His teeth were chattering. Mm. And I'd heard of people's teeth chattering, but I saw it. And he couldn't do anything, just stand there. So that calmed me down considerably because I got more concerned about him. But during that period of time of running, from the time I knew I had to try to run away from these people, that's when I daily did the praying, and all I could think about was my wife and the new baby that was coming along.
Uh-huh.
I wanted
them
to be.
And just
safe.
So our listeners are clear, these Hungarian civilians were after you because you guys had been bombing their villages. They saw you as the enemy. Yeah.
Yes, I suppose, but I was out in a kind of a rural area, and they were not hostile at all once they caught up to us.
Oh, really? Well, let's get to that part of the story.
So that helps, too, and I have no idea anymore how many there were, but probably a dozen.
Uh-huh.
And what was I, 19? Well, I guess I was 20.
Uh-huh.
And here's these guys that you're now at their mercy, and they're standing there asking who you are and that kind of stuff, and you tell them they want to know if you're Amerikonski, and you tell them yes. And So I'm looking each one of them in the eye for some reason or other, and I see this one guy in the second row. He was kind of older than the rest of them, and I just thought to myself then, boy, it was just you and I out here. We'd figure out how to get out of this thing, wouldn't we? So I thought I had a friend, but but by then some Hungarian soldiers actually showed up. And so they were in charge, and these other guys just kind of disappeared back to their work, I guess. So they finally rounded us all up in a truck, actually, and hauled us into town, little town there. But we were all there except Joe, who was the first pilot, who wasn't. And then I didn't know what had happened to him. I just didn't know what had happened to him. I just had hoped that he got out of the plane. He was in it longer than we were, so maybe he was still out there someplace, and maybe he was okay, but I didn't know.
And none of you knew what was going to happen to you, but I imagine it was a bit comforting to have the rest of your crew there with you, to not be on your own and completely alone.
That's very true. That's very true. There seemed to be strength in numbers or a feeling of safety in numbers. And even then, with just the crew, you didn't really feel comfortable until you got into a prison camp with several thousand people, you know.
Well, you've heard plenty of stories of prisoners of war being shot before they ever got to a prison camp. Malmedy Massacre comes to mind.
Right.
Hadn't been to probably only a month and a half before that or so. So what did happen to you? Did they march you? Did they put you in a 40-8? What'd they do?
Well, we were in a passenger train for a while. I wound up getting interrogated every step of the road. And I didn't know really what they were doing that for, because you could only tell them your name, rank, and serial number, and that's the end of it. And then you'd try to switch the subject to something else, and they'd get you back. And
did you ever have an interrogator who knew more about you than you knew about yourself?
Well, he knew where I was from, or where my family was from in Germany. They shipped all the Air Force people up to Frankfurt for interrogation.
Uh-huh.
And they had a big interrogation center there.
Was that Dulag Luft?
I don't know what the name of it was. Uh-huh. It was just an interrogation center in Frankfurt, Germany.
Yep.
And I thought I was there 9 days, because it seemed like longer than that. Maybe it was less than that. I'm not sure anymore. But it probably was less than that. But it seemed forever. I was in a room, didn't have a window.
Uh-huh.
And the only daylight I had was the crack under the door. I could see the light coming in there. So that way you knew which direction was up. And there was very, very, very little heat in there.
And this is January 1945. Yeah. Burr.
Yeah.
Coldest winter ever in Germany.
Very cold winter. Coldest winter on record yet
mm-hmm.
in Germany.
So how do you pass the time in that situation?
I had a comb in my pocket. And there was a radiator in the room. Heat. Hot water. And I would take a tooth out of that comb, and I would try to see if I could melt it on that cold radiator. That was one of the things, and it didn't work. But that was one of the things I did. You had nothing. You know, it's dark, and you either lay down, sit up, or stand up. And so we did get fed twice a day. And if you had to go to the bathroom, they had a handle out there. You could drop the arm. But without being told, I think if you drop that thing too frequently, and then they'd let you out to go to the bathroom.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they'd ignore you. And if it happened to be a time when you really had to go to the bathroom, you didn't want them ignoring you.
Don't want to be the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah. So.
In their interrogations of you, they ever threaten you? They ever scare you, intimidate you?
Well, at Frankfurt, even before I got to Frankfurt, I was threatened with going to a concentration camp because, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm in the Army. I got dog tags and all that. Well, anybody can make those.
Right.
And you can get that Army uniform if they want you over here as a spy or something, which was all a joke, but they just tried to scare you uh-huh. know, and threaten you with the concentration camp. And at Frankfurt, this guy was asking me questions, and all of a sudden these huge footsteps behind me, and I look around, and here's this guy with a gun, not pointed at me, but with a row of bullets here, I call them bullets, another one here.
Uh-huh. Bandoliers over his shoulders?
Bandoliers, that's uh-huh. the right word. And so he made you a little nervous, but he didn't do anything, he just stood there. But let you know he was in charge, I guess. Some of that's a little bit hazy now, but I can remember talking to that guy, and it was warm. I wasn't in that black cell.
Mm-hmm.
It was warm, and he had cigarettes, so I'd ask him, where do you get your tobacco? He said, from Turkey. He'd give you a cup of that ersatz coffee that didn't terrible taste and stuff, but and I wasn't even a coffee drinker at that time,
uh-huh.
but you drank it anyway. Went into one of the bathrooms one time, and here was a guy that couldn't get up to the toilet to do what he wanted to do, because his legs were broken.
From his interrogation?
So, no, I don't. Well, I don't know how they got broke.
Yeah.
I assumed it was in combat.
Oh, okay.
But you might be right. But anyway, I held him up to the toilet so he could go to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, the guards realized there was two people in there. And they come charging in there, you know, Ralph Smitten, whatever they said. And I guess we were done by that time because I had to leave him, and nobody had done it. I asked him if anybody was helping him. He says, no. But he says, well, he was on a plane because he said, I'm only about three of us survived or something like that.
And finally, they moved you to a prison camp in Nuremberg, Germany.
Right.
Stalag right. 13D? Is that
13D.
Right?
Had Italian prisoners in it. We didn't get moved right in with them. We were in a separate area. There was about 100 people there, 100 soldiers. That were captured in the Battle of the Bulge. They were all enlisted men
uh-huh.
that were in that camp before. I say 100. I don't know if that was 100 or 200. They were in another barracks. And they were using them to bury people in town. They'd haul them into town to bury people. But anyway, a short time later, all these Italian people that were interned for political reasons, I guess, were moved out. And they left, and they American prisoners of war were moved in. Mm-hmm. And they cleaned up those barracks, and they had big piles of stuff, and the Germans let them burn it to clean up. And I guess it was...
And you still had most of your crew with you? All
went
to the same
camp?
Well,
at this time, you just had Joe and Jackson, a navigator, and myself. And a bombardier that we'd picked up just for that mission.
And Joe was your pilot.
Joe was the pilot.
You didn't know what happened to him, but then he did end up
with
you.
I didn't have him there. That's right. I said I had him there. I didn't have him yet.
But he would show up there.
But he showed up at Nuremberg about probably a week after we got there. And moved right into the barracks that I was in. And so he and I commandeered a bunk there, and we slept together the rest of the winter there.
Try to stay warm in the coldest winter ever. Did that give you some relief to know that he was okay, to see his face again?
A lot of relief. A lot of relief. I was extremely pleased to see him come walking in there.
And you have no idea at this time how long the war is going to rage on. But as we know now, it was within 3 months of the end of the war. And the Germans were very short on supplies. It was hard to get anything anywhere. And these POW camps weren't exactly luxurious accommodations. The food was very sparse.
Yeah, it was. And no Red Cross parcels. We'd heard about them, but we didn't get any. And one time we got one shipment of Red Cross parcels that we divided between six people, which was good, compared to what we'd had before.
And if you get the soup and there's a little maggot in it or something?
One night we had potatoes in that soup, and I looked across at Joe, and I said, we could make it a long time if we had a meal like this every night, But you talk about, at that point in time, I never had any thought about not getting out of there. You have complete faith in the United States. They're going to come and get you. Even the short while I was there, I think if you didn't have that kind of faith, you would have gotten a lot worse shape.
It was hard to get. How much weight did you end up losing?
Probably 50 pounds, 40 pounds. I think I was about 140 pounds when I got out. You didn't get weighed for at least a week or more after you got out. But my first weight put me up to 160 pounds, and I was about 190 when I went down. We went from Nuremberg down to Moosburg. Where we marched.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. That's where we marched. We had to walk down there. And it took quite a while because I don't think they realized that we were coming. They didn't have any accommodations for us. The place was full. And so we just slept out on the ground when we got there. I was only there a couple of weeks and before the front went through and we were liberated. And then they flew us out of there. Yeah.
And I imagine that felt pretty nice.
Well, the two greatest sights of my life, one of them was the American flag going up on the flagpole in that camp. Because then you knew we were in charge.
And this is in Moosburg at Stalag 7A?
7A at Moosburg.
Uh-huh. So they moved you in early April from Nuremberg
right down
to Moosburg.
Yeah, we left Nuremberg April 14th, and we got into Moosburg. April 4th, we got into Moosburg 10 days later.
Uh-huh. And then on the 29th, you see that flag go up. You're liberated. And pretty soon you're going to be going home, and there might be a baby there waiting for you.
And there is. I fully expected that. I didn't know. I knew we had Michael until I got off the plane in New York, or off the boat in New York, and got my way to a pay phone, got some quarters, and called my wife. And first, I wanted to know how she was and all that. And she says, "Well, don't you want to know something?" And of course, I did. And what do we have? And she says, "We have a girl, Mary Jean." But the other sight was the Statue of Liberty.
I've heard so many veterans say that. What did that mean to you?
Your home.
That's beautiful. What you were fighting for, huh?
You bet. Beautiful. Yeah.
And I can tell it's still emotional for you now.
It still is, yeah. It probably wasn't then, but it's more now than it was then.
What about when you saw your daughter for the first time?
Well, we got home into Fargo. My wife came and met me came to Fort Snelling and met me in Minneapolis, and we were there a couple days. And then when we got home to Fargo, and she was living in an apartment. An ordinary home that had been turned into five apartments. And another lady there took care of her while Nancy was down. And, in fact, her mom had been visiting her just before that. So then this other lady took her. We went to her apartment, and this little baby was laying on the davenport. And she just rose up and looked, and that was the first time I saw my daughter. Yeah.
I imagine that's a pretty unforgettable moment for
you. Yeah, it is. It is.
So she was going to be here no matter what. But if you hadn't made it back from Stalag 13D and Stalag 7A and survived the war, how many more Gleasings, how many more children would not have been here if you hadn't made it back?
Well, we had a total of seven, so I guess that's six.
And how many grandkids now?
Incidentally, how many grandkids? About 15.
All right. Incidentally, what?
Well, we were going to have Michael, and we had five boys total, and Michael didn't make it.
You found seven other names.
They're all something else, yeah.
Absolutely. When you look back on it now, how do you account for what happened to you? Why do you think you got to come home and have seven children and 15 grandchildren in the life that you've had?
I know you start this program by talking about heroes. Well, the heroes, really, most of them didn't come home.
That includes over 400,000 Americans killed in World War II, and also the more than 81,000 from World War II through today's conflicts who remain missing in action. On National POW MIA Recognition Day, we honor and remember them. And we thank those like Al Finley and Jerry Gleasing for sharing their stories so the rest of us have a better understanding of what it means when we utter those four words that close this program each and every week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.